From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. You probably learned something about the Constitution when you were in school, but when it comes time to exercise the rights that that document affords us, it can get complicated. Unless you had a really, really good teacher, you might not have learned all the ins and outs of free speech as dictated by our courts and society. And here's another thing many students don't learn in school: life skills, like cooking and balancing a budget. Those topics used to be covered in home ec class.
Look, we all know home ec is a joke. No offense. It's just like everyone takes this class to get an A, and I'm sorry. And I'm not putting down your profession, but no offense. And I just think that I don't ever need to cook tiramisu. When am I going to need to cook tiramisu? Am I going to be a chef? No.
Today we'll tell you about an effort to bring back home ec, not as a joke, but as a way to equip kids with the skills they need to be self-sustaining, fully functioning adults. That's coming up this hour. First, though, we've had a lot of conversations about police reform in this show, and we'll have another one tomorrow, actually, with a chief of police from DeKalb County. We love it when you weigh in with ideas on how to improve relations between law enforcement and the communities they serve. So here are your first thoughts. April B. tweets, imagine if top priorities included 1. Curtailing police privilege to testify at grand jury for police use of force cases. 2. Harsher penalties when police falsify police reports or lie during investigations. And 3. Mandating independent prosecutors for police fatal use of force cases. Very specific, April. We love getting thoughts like this and your ideas. You can call us with yours at 404-500-9457. Tweet us like April B. did at OST Talk or post on our Facebook page. And of course, we might feature your comments on the show. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs has been plagued by a lot of problems in recent years. There have been major gaps in care, complaints about very long wait times, and even some patient deaths. A recent ProPublica investigation finds even more problems afflicting the department. ProPublica found there have been thousands of patient privacy violations every year, and they are on the rise. One of the places where it's particularly bad is the VA's Sunshine Healthcare Network, and that includes Southern Georgia. ProPublica reporter Annie Waldman joins me now to talk about what she and her team discovered. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
I want to make sure that everybody understands first a couple terms. I imagine that one of the things you're going to be saying a lot is HIPAA, which is an acronym for the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act that comes from the 1990s. What kind of rights or protections does HIPAA, is it supposed to afford us?
Sure. So under HIPAA, which, as you said, is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, medical providers are responsible for keeping patients' medical information confidential, meaning that information has to remain private. Releasing any patient's treatment information is actually illegal if you don't have the patient's consent. And in particular, VA employees who have access to medical records are only supposed to access the minimum necessary of patients' files in order to perform their jobs. But what we found is that's not always the case.
What was your first inclination? What made you look into this story?
Yeah, sure. So we started actually looking at the Office for Civil Rights, which is within the Department of Health and Human Services. And we were really looking at, you know, what is the world of privacy? And we wanted to know, particularly in healthcare, what are the privacy rights that people have? And when we started to look at the Office for data from the Office for Civil Rights, we noticed that the VA had more privacy violations in their data and privacy complaints than any other healthcare system. So then we started to request data from the VA directly to see what kind of complaints were in there, what kind of violations were in there.
You know, I don't want to give away because some of the things that you discovered were pretty shocking, but yeah. Maybe you can describe some of perhaps the more egregious things you discovered.
Sure. Well, just before we get to the egregious things, I want to, you know, first say that according to the filings we received through our FOIA requests, many of the privacy violations and data breaches appear to be actually inadvertent mistakes. They can cause a lot of grief, but they're not actually always intentional. For example, sending documents or prescriptions to the wrong people. My colleague Charles Ornstein, I heard him on before, he was talking about the widows who were receiving the wrong documents regarding benefits following the deaths of their husbands, and that can cause a lot of grief following, you know, any kind of when your husband passes away or your wife passes away. But one example that we showcased in our article was Anthony McCann, who is a veteran from Tennessee. He received a thick manila envelope from the Department of Veterans Affairs last year, full of 250 pages of deeply revealing personal information on another veteran's mental health care. Of course, he had expected to get his own records. And this wasn't the first time he'd received another veteran's medical records. In the past, he normally just threw them away and told the VA about their mistake. But this time, he wanted to actually approach the VA and tell them about it. He did this at a town hall, and he berated them for their mistake. And when an official asked for the documents back, he refused to give the documents back because he just didn't trust the VA and their ability to safeguard the material and actually get it into the hands of the veteran who actually the documents belong to.
I want to, another term I want to make sure everyone knows is you mentioned FOIA, that's Freedom of Information Act,
sure.
and that's the mechanism that allows reporters or really anybody to file to get information that should be publicly available. I want to give the response from the VA, John Oswald, who's the VA's Associate Deputy Assistant Secretary for Privacy and Records Management, said this: "We take any loss of data very seriously. Over a third of our employees are veterans. We have a vested interest in protecting that data personally, too." And from a written statement from the PA of the VA, they said inappropriate access of patient health records, either during or post-treatment, is absolutely unacceptable and in violation of privacy laws and regulations, VA policies and procedures and our principles. Okay, so if the VA acknowledges that this is serious and that it's
yes.
inappropriate, what caused it? I mean, you said some of them are inadvertent, although, frankly, sending the wrong widow information about a dead veteran doesn't seem small to me. But what is causing these breaches in privacy?
You know, I think a lot of it might be the fact that employees have access, and there are no locks really barring people who are not part of the medical care team. In a way, it's a word of honor system. When an employee at the VA attempts to go into a sensitive file of a patient whose medical care they are not involved in, what happens is a pop-up appears on the screen. There's some text that describes HIPAA or privacy code, essentially saying, "Are you sure you want to enter this record?" And you have to select yes. And that's how we know that sometimes, even though it might be inadvertent, sometimes it's intentional. And it seems that, you know, a lot of employees are doing this out of curiosity.
Wait, explain that to me. Out of curiosity?
Yeah, so now we're getting into some of the more, I guess you could say, egregious violations, which are the more intentional violations. So when we looked at the records, we saw that employees repeatedly accessed the medical records of patients not under their care, from coworkers to suicidal vets to whistleblowers. For example, we found one report describing an employee who accessed her ex-husband's medical record more than 260 times. Another employee in our records we found peeked into the records of a patient 61 times and then posted the details on Facebook.
Oh my.
We also found...
Wait, stop. I'm sorry. Stop for just a second. I mean, I read your article and my mind is still boggling. You found no justifiable medical reason for these people to be looking at someone's records 260 times?
None. So what we can only assume from, you know, the bits and pieces that we pick up in these records is that, you know, there aren't the locks on the system. And so people continue to just go in out of curiosity or for some personal reason.
Well, one of the things that often prevents someone from making these kind of violations is when you get caught, when they find out that an employee has accessed a record they weren't supposed to look at or shared it on Facebook, for God's sake,
right.
There are serious consequences. Have there been consequences for employees of the VA when it's been discovered that they've done something inappropriate?
Right. Well, what we saw in the data was that the VA often resorts to extra training, for example, giving more information on privacy, the Privacy Act and HIPAA laws, and also using internal reprimands, putting employees on temporary leave, or even firing employees if it gets to be very bad. But the Office for Civil Rights within Health and Human Services also can play a role. That's a federal agency which is generally charged with enforcing HIPAA. In another story, Charles and I also looked at those complaints and found, as I said before, that the VA was the most cited. But we did not find that the VA was actually fined, which they can be given fines of up to $50,000 per violation. And we did not find that once.
Okay. So one of the places that you focused on that was perhaps the most egregious among many egregious things was the Sunshine Healthcare Network, which includes Southern Georgia. Sorry, I'm distracted. Anna, your pages are very loud. If you want to pull your page turning a little further away from the mic. But you looked at the Sunshine Healthcare Network. When you say that this was among the worst offenders, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so we found at the VA Sunshine Healthcare Network, which you said includes Southern Georgia, as well as the entire state of Florida and Puerto Rico, we found more privacy incidents there than any other region, with at least 370 incidents over the past 5 years. And as I said, that includes the entire state of Florida. So we believe that it's an area of the country that has a high population and presumably also has a lot of veterans. So my guess is it has something to do with that. But given that there might be a higher population there, there should be a greater attention to the veterans who are there and toward their privacy needs.
I want to mention that we did reach out to the VA for comment. We did not get a response back. The VA did respond to your investigation, however. What did the VA say?
Yeah, they said, as you said before, that patient privacy is a top priority. And also they mentioned that the VA does run the largest integrated healthcare system in the nation, with 150 hospitals, hundreds of clinics, and they serve around 9 million patients annually. So they do have a large population. But they also said that the increase could be a result of more knowledge of privacy laws. And it could be an indication that employees are feeling more encouraged to report potential breaches and privacy violations. People are more aware that their data, their healthcare information, their files are indeed private and should be protected. But at the end of the day, many of these privacy violations just shouldn't be occurring in the first place.
I've been speaking with ProPublica reporter Annie Waldman. She recently investigated the rising number of patient privacy violations at VA medical facilities. You can find that story at our Facebook page, facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. And if you're a Georgia veteran, we want to hear from you. Annie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Before you go, here's a story that you might be interested in, and in fact, you might have already seen something about it on your Facebook timeline. This weekend, Atlanta rapper Black Youngsta went to the bank to withdraw $200,000, as one does. But as he was leaving the bank, he was detained by police. He posted a photo on Instagram showing him lying on the ground in handcuffs with an officer standing over him. But Atlanta police say it was a matter of mistaken identity. The police had been called about a man trying to cash a large, possibly fraudulent check at the bank, and the description of the suspect was, they say, quote, limited and conflicting. So police say the rapper was briefly detained and then released. Black Youngsta say police also confiscated $100,000 from him, but then returned it later. So why did he need $200,000 in cash? That's because he was going to buy a new car, and he says, quote, I'm a millionaire. How can I not have $200,000 on me? The rapper says he was in the market for either a Ferrari or a Maybach, although a Maybach can cost $500,000 or so. Just a side note here, just in case you questioned my pronunciation of that particular brand of car, it is true that many hip-hop artists, possibly including Black Youngsta, say Maybach. But the automaker is a German company, and the correct pronunciation is Maybach. Don't believe me?
Maybach.
I'm assuming back is just easier to rhyme than Bach. This is On Second Thought. I stand on my First Amendment rights. How many times have you heard that? People invoke the First Amendment in all kinds of situations. But I'm willing to bet many people who talk about free speech don't actually know what the right to free speech is. And I'm also willing to bet many people who talk about the First Amendment don't really know what the First Amendment says or does. So, let's break it down.
Ooh, break it down, baby, because I want y'all all to know. Let me break it down for you again.
Break it down now.
Break it down.
Let's go back to the beginning, and that doesn't mean 1791 when the Bill of Rights was ratified. Let's go back a little further. Back when the English king was still our master and our speech was not protected. You weren't allowed to criticize the government, and you couldn't publish anything without a license from the government.
If I lose my temper, you lose your head. Understand?
That wasn't the biggest reason the colonies decided to rebel, but it was pretty important. In 1776, 2 years into the Revolutionary War, Virginia passed a Declaration of Rights, and it said this, quote, "Freedom of the press is one of the greatest bulwarks of liberty and can never be restrained but by despotic governments," end quote. Aha! Did you forget that freedom of the press is also included in the First Amendment? It's just one sentence long, but there's a lot packed in there. Let's read the original amendment, shall we?
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
So in that one sentence, we get freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly for peaceful protests, and the freedom to complain to the government when you think they've done you wrong.
Free speech is only important if it's offensive. If you're not going to offend anybody, you don't need protection of the First Amendment.
That's Larry Flint there of Hustler fame. I want you to notice something else as well. The First Amendment only talks about what Congress can't do. It doesn't mention your neighbor or your school or someone on Twitter. Just Congress, and that means the government. I mention that because if you tell a guy that his wife is ugly...
Them's fighting words!
Yeah, them's fighting words!
The First Amendment doesn't protect you from a punch in the mouth. It just means you have the right to say what you want without being arrested or fined by the government. And free speech has been pretty hotly contested from the beginning. Just a few years after the Bill of Rights was ratified, Congress adopted the Alien and Sedition Acts. These were a set of laws that clamped down hard on any criticism of the government. Those laws also made it legal to inter and deport a number of Japanese Americans, Germans, and Italians during World War II. And there are a number of other limitations.
Free speech is okay, but there have to be consequences for offensive speech, no?
Okay. Yeah, free speech is okay as long as you speak the way I want you to, brother.
Legally, the freedom of speech in the U.S. is not absolute. Let's talk about all the things you might say that are not necessarily protected by the First Amendment. Number one, obscenity.
Well, I hope you're satisfied.
What?
Every word out of my son's mouth now is
Number two, child pornography. Number three, defamation.
Yo mom is so fat. When she went to school, she sat next to the whole class.
Oh, come on, guys. She's not that fat.
Number four, intentional infliction of harm. And that includes that infamous example of that you can't yell fire in a crowded theater if you know there's no fire. Number five, invasion of privacy.
How much do you get paid? How do you afford this condo?
Who's been in your bed lately?
You are invading my privacy and I need a restraining order against you.
Number six, issues of national security. And number seven, political spending.
They think that money corrupts in politics and they're looking to stop that, quote, corruption.
I guess the rule here is money is free speech.
There are a few others, like a school has a lot of control over what's printed in the school paper and what kids say at school events. But let's talk about obscenity for just a moment. This is a really tough area because one person might think something's obscene while someone else thinks it's fine. We currently use what's called the Miller test to settle these arguments. It's also called the three-prong obscenity test. The official language comes from a 1973 Supreme Court case, but one expert summed it up this way. Number one, is it porn? Number two, does it actually show sex? Number three, is it otherwise useless? If the answer to all three questions is yes, then legally, it's obscene, and it's not protected by the First Amendment. We could go down the rabbit hole of all the legalities surrounding the First Amendment, but let's keep it simple, shall we?
The point about it is the moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech. The point about it is that it's free.
What does it mean that we have the right to free speech? And here I'll quote former Justice Thurgood Marshall. Quote, "Our people are guaranteed the right to express any thought free from government censorship." And this is probably the most misunderstood facet of the First Amendment. You have the right to say what you like, but you're not protected from the consequences of what you say. The government won't prevent you from saying it, you won't be censored, and you won't be arrested, but you're not protected from losing your job or other negative outcomes. And now let's shift gears to a real-life First Amendment case that might end up in the U.S. Supreme Court. It involves a Mississippi teenager suspended because of rap lyrics that he wrote. The lyrics were designed to raise awareness about alleged sexual misconduct at his school. The student has gotten widespread support, though, from some big names. That includes Atlanta rappers T.I., Big Boy, and Killer Mike. The Supreme Court will consider whether or not to hear this case next month. So with me now to talk about it is University of Georgia law professor Andrea Dennis. Hi there.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for asking. One of the things that I mentioned just now in trying to explain the First Amendment was that schools actually have a lot of control over what's printed, what's said by schools at school, by kids at school events. Can you kind of give me a brief explanation of what kind of control schools have over speech by students?
Sure. I think it's important to keep in mind that children do have constitutional rights, but once they are in the school system, the school setting, their rights are limited, both because they are children and constantly in a state of learning, but also because school officials need to have the ability to maintain the safety and security of students and teachers and administrators in the school. So what that means generally is that whenever students are involved in school activities or using school resources producing information, engaging in communication, that schools have the ability to limit in order to prevent disruption of the school day, whether that's just that children are in a fair and large amount going to be inattentive to what's happening in school, or whether that's going to create a security issue for the school on a particular day. So in those circumstances, school administrators have the ability to limit what children say, when they say it, how they might say it, and whether they can even say it.
So let's actually hear a portion of this song. This is Mississippi teenager Taylor Bell. He goes by the name T. Bizzle. And this is a song called PSK the Truth. And he's calling out two gym teachers for allegedly sexually harassing female students. Here it is.
Heard you dancing number 25, you wanna get it on. White dude, guess you got a thing for them yellow bone. Looking down, girl, shirt, drool running down your mouth. With the wrong one, gon' get a pistol down your mouth. Pow! OMG. Feel some girls in the locker room and PE. Cut off the lights, you motherfucking free. F***ing with them youngins, cause your pimpin' can't read.
So there's a couple things that I hear and I listen to the whole thing, Andrea. Number one, can we talk about the fact that he's talking about grabbing a pistol and putting it down somebody's mouth? Would that be considered a threat, even though it's in a song?
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, what you have to understand, right, is Taylor Bell was known to be an aspiring rap artist. He mm-hmm. had been working at his craft. He understood or was learning to utilize the poetic devices that are often used in rap lyrics. And one of the poetic devices might be violent imagery or reference to firearms to make a point. And so in some sense, I think maybe if you read them literally and without context, maybe an individual might understand them to be a threat, but I think it's better understood that he is trying to convey a point about the alleged behavior in which these teachers were engaging, and that in the context of rap music, he was using traditional, commonly understood poetic devices to make that point.
So let's forget that he's a student for just a moment, because we have had some court tests of free speech in rap songs particularly, and in especially in reference to violent lyrics. What is our current standing in terms of your First Amendment rights to protection if you're in hip hop?
Well, sure. It's actually still an open question. The courts in general haven't addressed the First Amendment issues with respect to use of rap lyrics in criminal cases and as threats. Last term, the Supreme Court, in the case of Alanis versus United States, did interpret a federal criminal threat statute, but it avoided the constitutional questions. But at least in that instance, in which a defendant was charged with crafting some rap lyrics that were considered considered threatening with respect to his estranged wife. The court ruled that in interpreting that statute and determining whether or not the communication was a threat, the standard is whether or not the individual purposely issues a threat or knows that his communication will be viewed as a threat. So in that instance, we're really looking at the defendant and focusing on his mind state and whether he was in engaging in wrongdoing.
This is something, though, that I didn't entirely understand when I was reading reports on that decision. That's because it's the court decided that the person who wrote the lyrics had to know whether the person would interpret it as a threat. And that seems really subjective to me. Couldn't anybody say I thought that was a threat?
Yeah, so that's actually one of the critiques of the court's decision, that it didn't really help refine this notion of, well, what do we do when individuals might interpret a threat and they might mistake a communication as a threat and not have the particular context or the background in order to really think about that communication. For example, we know that individuals might read a posting on social media and not at all know the context that might have been going on in the backdrop between those who are communicating, right? The backstory or
right.
What
happened.
Right.
They might read the 30th tweet in a series and not
Correct.
Have seen the whole conversation.
Correct. And so, unfortunately, the court's decision doesn't go far enough in necessarily helping us resolve completely those situations. But the court was clear that it has to be that the individual purposely issues a threat or knows that the statement will be viewed as a threat. And so how much we consider the subjective understanding of general individuals or the person to whom the threat was directed it remains to be seen.
So then now let's remember that he is a student again, and we're speaking about the Mississippi teenager Taylor Bell, known by T. Bizzle for art purposes, and a song he wrote about a couple gym teachers at his school. So let's go back to his rights as a student. Could it be considered that because he's writing about gym teachers, because this is something that ended up being shared by a lot of students, could that be considered part of school activities and therefore coming under the purview of limitations by the school administration?
Well, probably not that it's part of school activities, but the language that courts often use is that it's directed at the school. It's clear that he wrote the lyrics outside of school hours on his own personal time, that he did not utilize any school resources, that it was not published in any school publications, right? And it was considered to be directed at the school, though, because, as you pointed out, he named the teachers directly. He identified them. He called them out. He was writing about a matter occurring in the school. He knew that some of those who would hear his song were students and at the same school. And so it would reach the school in that sense. So it's interesting here. It's a little bit ironic. Even though all of this was done after hours on his own time without school resources, because he was clearly speaking about a matter of school importance and students would understand it and eventually it would get back to the school, it's considered to be directed at the school. And so that raises the question.
Part of the reasons there's that kind of latitude is because of violence that has occurred at school and also bullying, especially cyberbullying, that has in some ways made schools more intrusive in what you release on social media. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think part of what is going on here is the particular concerns about school violence that we have long been dealing with and more recently cyberbullying.
So what are the chances, do you think, Andrea, that the Supreme Court would take this up?
Well, anytime an individual asks the Supreme Court to take the case, it's a long shot. The court gets thousands of petitions and only takes a very limited number of cases. But what's interesting here is that we're beginning to see more and more this question of how schools should handle students' behavior outside of school, during personal time, but through the use of social media, which other students will learn about and which can ultimately reach the school. So that question sort of how schools need to think about dealing with student conduct and behavior in this new area of social media is one that the court will have to eventually consider. I think at some point, whether they are interested in doing that now remains to be seen. I think also it's interesting because the court did just last term take up a case at least involving the question of rap lyrics. And so you're not going to say necessarily that the court or the justices will want to deal with rap again, but maybe it will be of interest to them in some respect.
And that brings me to my last question. And sadly, I only have about 1 minute to give you to answer this. But do you think that perhaps some of these big name rappers, T.I. and Big Boi, are interested in this because they're afraid that a decision against this kid would also in the end impact entertainers like themselves and their free speech rights in hip hop?
Sure. I think there is obviously the concern about some possible creep from the schoolhouse to the greater public in terms of limitation of constitutional rights. I think also they are just genuinely interested in protecting their art form and protecting the ability of kids to learn about their art form and develop their artistic craft. I think they're also concerned about the possible uses in the criminal justice system. It's been over a decade in which prosecutors have been using lyrics to charge individuals with criminal behavior and prove criminal behavior. And I think these artists, even though they are professional and commercially successful, are concerned about what's happening to amateur or aspiring artists.
That's University of Georgia Law Professor Andrea Dennis. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
The Supreme Court might decide next month to weigh in on this case, and we would like to know if you think music lyrics should be used to build up a case against someone. You can reach us on Twitter or at Facebook as well. This is On Second Thought.
Spit on the ground, hold your breath, try to scare yourself to death, bury your bones under the dirt.
Chef Hugh Atchison is considered to be one of the country's top culinary minds, especially here in Georgia. He owns four restaurants around the state. He's written a slew of best-selling cookbooks. And, of course, there's his role as a judge on the hit show Top Chef.
I realize maybe they didn't fully integrate the flavor of the rose petal jelly into it. If you get too much, it feels like you're eating somebody's grandmother. It's like just, I mean, it's like perfume.
But Hugh Atchison has another life off camera. He's also invested in education, and he's created a new home economics curriculum for middle school students in Georgia that might help improve their culinary literacy. It's always great to have you, Hugh. Welcome back.
Well, it's good to be here, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. And I wonder if you'd start by telling me what culinary literacy is.
You know, I think that we lost some traction in the food world somehow in the last 60 years. We adopted convenience and we forgot how to cook. So to me, sort of culinary literacy is just understanding the basics of food, understanding how to cook food from scratch again in the most simple way possible. It's poaching an egg and making a vinaigrette and having that sort of understanding of food that makes it real, that there's a connection to it and that we're going to raise kids who can say, I got this.
So you're not talking about knowing what a truffle is or...
I don't need more chefs in the world, Celeste. Honestly, we don't. I mean, a couple more in my kitchens would be good now and again because, you know, it's hard to find good people. But no, I just want to raise a generation that understands food more than the previous generation does and did.
I mean, the fact that you're creating this curriculum implies that you think this is a need that's not being fulfilled in the school system now.
You know, I put it this way. We have family and consumer sciences, which is the modern term for home ec, in most public schools in Georgia. A lot of it's been canceled, and a lot of they've been getting away from it a little bit. And the curriculum that there is sometimes taught by thoroughly nuanced teachers who are really invested in it and really bring a lot to it. But the core curriculum is really dated. And so what I want to do is I just want to make it much more contemporary so it's a nuanced, interesting curriculum taught by nuanced, interesting, amazingly empowered teachers. And that combination, I think, is much more powerful than we've got now.
One of the things that kind of sparked this, I understand, was because your daughter took the class and they were teaching her.
Not very good stuff. I mean, just basic stuff. A lot of sort of Rice Krispie treats and how to make red velvet cupcakes and things like that. And we all love those things. They're treats in this world.
But they were teaching them to make red velvet cupcakes from a Betty Crocker mix.
Right. They're pretty instant. And then making instant croissants out of a tube and wrapping them in bacon and baking them in the oven. And that's not to say that there aren't sort of some skill sets that you can learn from that stuff. But what about if I can teach retainable knowledge to a kid? And this is all kids, regardless of color, creed, class, economic scale, where they live. This is all in the state of Georgia. This can happen, that we have all these kids learning how to poach an egg or make a vinaigrette or make a super roasted chicken or learning how to read a cell phone contract or learning about a lease because they're going to sign one eventually. And a lot of these kids just are going into this and they're just going into it blind. We're just not equipping them to me, it's like merit badges. I want to give these kids merit badges for the future and empower them to feel like they can really tackle these problems of life.
So help me understand how this works, because it seemed to me that for a lot of schools that many of them got rid of home ec classes quite some time ago, which means they probably also got rid of those classroom kitchens. So if you're making something from scratch, you need more than an oven. I mean, you need to teach knife skills.
You do. I mean, we'll be live for grade six in Athens, Clark County, and four middle schools next year. Now, they have home ec classrooms still in all of those schools. They have amazing programs of ag science and things like this. So we're utilizing a lot of those things. So these classrooms still exist in a lot of places. So we're trying to do it in a very budget-minded way. We're going into, hopefully, the existing slot of Hamley Consumer Sciences and just revamping the curriculum that's there. We're giving them new skill sets and new sort of topics to cover that are really nuanced and accompanied by great videos produced at Google and really good step-by-step knife work and step-by-step how to do this recipe. And this is core stuff. But imagine if all these kids in 8 years can be 19, 20 years old and know how to make a great salad and cook farro and rice and roasted chicken. Then we change the whole paradigm of how these kids are living. I mean, we know that good food creates better humans, right? We know that. But we're
in a lot of different ways, not just physiologically.
In so many different ways. And it's empowering to be able to feed yourself and your family. And we're just not teaching these kids those core skills. So that's what this is about. But it's not just about food. It's about sort of DIY and life hacks. It's about fixing things before replacing them. It's about how to read that cell phone contract and why you don't lease a car when it's your first automobile, or how to sign a lease for the first time, or just the really basic ideas. It's auto renewals and subscriptions that we all look at our bank statements these days and we're like, wow, why did they charge me again for that? I thought I canceled it a year ago. And it's because you clicked the little auto renewal thing. And we just don't understand like the gravitas of what this all means in our daily routine. And I think we just need to get to the bottom of it and equip these kids with skills that really matter.
So this kind of came up in my own home recently because my son had a friend over and he told his friend, my mom's making bread. And he's like, wow, how do you do that? And my son's like, flour, water, and some yeast.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? You know, and the kid was blown away that that's all that was in bread.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, didn't understand the science of how flour, water, and a little yeast became a loaf of bread. I mean, that's a great moment for me to tell, but how does that then translate into more self-sufficient human being if I'm teaching that?
Because to get over what I call the age of convenience, the last 80 years of us buying into the ease of buying things made for us, fast food, you know, shelves and shelves of pre-prepared food items, to get away from that and to live in a healthy world again, we have to understand the basic crux of food, that when we mix this with this, we create this from scratch. We have to reintroduce the idea of value into food in the way that I can actually produce a great meal for four for $10, which you'd be hard-pressed to go to McDonald's and buy enough food for a family of four for $10 these days. So this is we're trying to rip the sort of facade that food is fancy, food is difficult, food is something you shouldn't be able to try at home anymore. And we just need to make sure people understand that we can all do this. It's really, really straightforward. So, but that's like bread. I mean, people just do not understand the basic tenets of food anymore. So we're just trying to reintroduce that into their lives.
So does this translate into another area? I know your guys are starting in Athens, but you're looking ahead to a year or two and turning it into a national program. Do you have to make changes when you leave Athens, Georgia, and take it to, say, Iowa or Seattle?
No, I think the good thing about the current state of food policy and the current state of education in the United States is we're all on a similar playing field. We all need to work on these things. And I think that we're creating a curriculum that's not geographically specific. Seasons change, little things change here and there, but I think there's still a core context from Portland, Oregon to Portland, Maine to Miami, Florida to, you know, Southern Arizona that is, you know, how do you poach an egg? You know, we need to learn that. Regardless, that's not regionally specific. And how to make a vinaigrette is not regionally specific. But these are both things that take 3 or 4 minutes. And they're really core cooking ideas. And if they usurp that idea of going to the fast food drive-in for dinner, then we've won. And we need to win over and over and over again, because we need to create the next generation who feels totally empowered, like they got this. And cooking is that thing. It's like people who cook on a regular basis, they just got this.
I wonder how that, in terms of teaching and engaging students, one of the things I found interesting was that in the plan for the digital and online curriculum is you're going to bring in people like Jacques Pepin and have him teach how to poach an egg. What's the value in that? I mean, your average 15-year-old doesn't know who he is, right? So where do you get benefit from the celebrities coming in to teach these basic techniques?
I think you want retainable stuff. And the way you get retainable stuff is you have this crazy guy who's deep French accent, but he's ebullient and awesome and brilliant and will teach somebody in a way that hopefully they'll really remember. And we still have those little iterances of times in our back to our elementary school days and our middle school days where somebody taught us something and it still sticks with us. So we're just trying to make sure that every lesson in this is really tied to that notion, that we can really grasp at it and really remember it. Because I don't remember algebra, but I would remember Jacques Pepin teaching me how to poach an egg. and I don't remember trig all that well, but I would remember Tom Colicchio teaching me how to make a really simple salad. So these are the ideas and hopefully the connections I've got to make this just a little more well-rounded and really an approachable and retainable sort of way of learning.
Who did that for you? When you think back to the very basics of food, what are the lessons that stick in your head that you actually do remember?
You know, I started working at such a young age that it was more in restaurants, starting when I was 14, and that helped me a lot later on. You know, I was a much better human, not just because I knew how to cook professionally, but just because I knew how to cook. So when I went off to university, I'd never finished, but I was a hit definitely because people would come over and we would make dinner and it would be really economical and really smart. But we were living in Montreal and having a good life, and everybody would sort of pitch in $2, $3, and we make a big supper. And we just need those type of basic skill sets. So, I mean, there's so many ways that we learn, but this is just one way of making sure it's really retainable.
Do you think that part of, say, for example, the obesity crisis in mm-hmm. the United States is connected to this disconnection with our food and food preparation?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, it's very documented that when you have Dunkin' Donuts for breakfast and McDonald's for lunch and Kentucky Fried Chicken for dinner, your chances of having a really successful time in school and paying attention and having a good, well-rounded life of good health, your chances are slim. So we need to make sure that we're raising a generation that can feed themselves and feed themselves with skill sets and really go back to the times. You know, I'm not looking for that time way past 100 years ago when everybody made food from scratch and we all had little gardens and occasionally we killed a chicken in the yard. I mean, we're modern. This is very contemporary, but it's really important to be able to make an omelet, and it's really important to be able to make soup at home because sometimes you just need to. And I think that disconnect has caused, and the convenience items that we eat every day and that just the ready-made food has really contributed to those type 2 diabetes and obesity rates and just sort of a non-learning society when it comes to core skills.
And one of the things that you have referred to is that in our effort to focus on the STEM education, science and technology and mathematics, that perhaps we've left behind what we think of home ec or the domestic sciences because we don't think of them as advanced. Can you both train somebody to be not a chef, but a good passable cook to be able to make their bread if they're out of bread and be an advanced technologist?
You know, we hope to create better citizens through this. And I think that better citizens understand food. And when you understand food, you understand ratios and you understand percentages and you understand that a great vinaigrette is 3 parts oil and 1 part acid. And then when you're out in a garden at a school, because they all have gardens now, you can understand that this seed is producing this amount of food and this is doing this. And then photosynthesis occurs and all these things. And this is when we harvest this, and this is why we're harvesting. This is what happens when we poach an egg in protein coagulation. I mean, there's just so much that you can bring into it to satisfy STEM and STEAM attributes of learning and education these days that are so much more rewarding and really can impact later testing and things like that.
Yeah, that's why a lot of people don't bake, because it's such a precise science.
Right, and it
the is. Chemistry is so precise.
But that's the beauty of it, and that's the beauty that we need to teach to people, is that science and math, though I don't remember a lot of the math I learned at school, I do this every day because we're following recipes and we're writing recipes and we're writing ratios and we're figuring out complex theories and complex ideas of food. What I want to do is get back to this time of saying, you know, I mean, we also used to say things like, you know, I used to make jam with my grandmother. But we never say I made jam with my mother, because mom bought us Smuckers. And we just need to realize that there's a world there that's beautiful in making food from scratch. So if I cook at home tonight, later on, or tomorrow, my kids are around the house and they're seeing me cook, and they engage with me and they help me out. But they're learning through that too. But then we sit down and we have dinner, and that's what the average American household isn't doing right now, is they're not gathering around the table. And I also say this a lot. You're never going to have a beautiful family moment over a bunch of pizza pockets. You have a beautiful family moment over a home-cooked meal that means something to you, that was bought and purchased by farmers you know, that had skill sets going into it. And it can be simple. It could be a roasted chicken and some rice and a beautiful salad and some roasted broccoli. But if you made that from scratch and your kids saw you do it, you've just taught them something that's equipping them with life skills. And that's more important than any pizza pocket can ever be. So it's just a moment, and it's cool, and we need more of those moments.
Do your kids bring their own lunches to school?
You know, Beatrice, who's now 13, I remember this scampering around the kitchen when she was 5 years old, and it was the first day of school, and she was going off to kindergarten at Chase Street Elementary right around the corner from our house. And she was making a salad, and she was making a vinaigrette from scratch in a mason jar because she knew how to do it at five. And she was packing it separately to dress later. And to me, you know, very proud chef father, I was weepy. But she had learned something, and she had learned something that she will never forget. Bea's a special kid, super smart and raised in a very culinary household, but this could be any kid. And life's just better when you know those skills and when you've got it.
Chef Hugh Atchison, he's the founder of Seed Life Skills. It's an organization with plans to change the way schools teach home economics. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow we'll talk with the chief of police in DeKalb County. He's part of a group that wants to reform police practices and training. What questions do you have for your police chief? If you sat down for a chat with your chief of police, what would you ask him or her? Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us at OSD Talk or post on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.